coming up on the Travis Makes Friends podcast.
So when we get a body...
Okay, but how are you getting a body?
If you're able to learn anatomy just as a baseline, it's almost like learning a language. You know how, like, if you learn second language, it's easier to learn the third, the fourth, the fifth.
Yeah.
You learn anatomy, you speak the language of the body, and it becomes immensely easier. The only thing I know about these body donors is their age and what they passed from. I don't know any of their medical history.
Oh,
so I've kind of called it Sherlock Holmesing. When you're working with the dead, you can't help but reflect on life.
Hmm.
And that's in all aspects. So I am constantly confronted with my own mortality. And that is on the forefront of my mind.
Welcome back to the show. I'm Travis Chappell, and I believe that if you can connect with the best, you can become the best. So after creating 800 podcast episodes about building your network, I've come to realize that networking is really just making friends, if you're doing it the right way anyway. Join me as I make friends with world-class athletes like Shaquille O'Neal, entertainers like Rob Dyrdek, authors like Dr. Nicole LaPera, former presidents like Vicente Fox, or even the occasional FBI hostage negotiator, billionaire real estate mogul, or polarizing political figure. So if you want to make more friends that help you become a better version of yourself, then subscribe to the show and keep on listening, because this is Travis Makes Friends. What's going on, everybody? Welcome back to another episode of the Travis Makes Friends podcast. Today, I'm making friends with Justin Cottle from the Institute of Human Anatomy. And today we're going to be talking all things human body. Their YouTube channel has almost 7 million subscribers because they're famous for just showing you cadavers showing you different things about how the body reacts to certain topics like alcohol and smoking and exercise and how to build muscle, but through the lens of actually physically showing you a human body that's like decomposing in front of them. So there's this really cool visual aspects led to almost 7 million subscribers on YouTube. They're adding a ton of value in the world of health, fitness, nutrition, just trying to educate people around that space. So I thought this would be an interesting conversation. Justin, what's up, man? Welcome to the show.
Happy to be here.
Yes, sir. So let's rewind the clock, man. Let's rewind the clock. I want to dig into your past here before we talk about some more like practical topics, which I definitely want to talk about.
Yeah, sure.
Let's say, 7-8-year-old Justin, what set the scene? Where are you? What are you doing? What are your parents doing?
So 7-8-year-old Justin, I am living in Salt Lake City, Utah. So born and raised. I'm outdoors, to be honest. That's okay. Really what I am. But I mean, so my parents, my family, I really just kind of grew up very average, very, middle class, nothing really surprising, nothing really exciting, just kind of living day to day. And just kind of living in the suburbs just outside of Salt Lake City, Utah, nothing real exciting there for sure.
What did your parents do?
So dad was a postal carrier, so worked for the post office. Okay. Mom, she did a variety of jobs, mainly stay-at-home mom for a period of time. Then she would do, administrative work wherever she could find it.
What would you say would be the greatest influence as to why you ended up in the career field that you ended up in?
It was random. So, I mean, it's kind of like, for me, I think it's kind of, there's a really unconventional path to getting to where I'm at. And it really, I think, started because I joined the United States Marine Corps. So I did that when I was 18.
Okay.
And when I got out of the Marines, I didn't really have an idea of what I was going to do outside of knowing that I had a post 9/11 GI Bill. It's time to use that, go to college. Hmm. But I was struggling like a lot of veterans do. And I actually couldn't focus. I had to drop out of college. And what I ended up doing was trying to kind of like gather myself, get used to being a civilian again. And ended up, of all places, actually going to a massage school.
Okay.
Just randomly. The idea was kind of like, I'm used to this hyper aggression in the United States Marines. I was like, maybe I could deal with some softness.
Huh.
I literally viewed it as a sabbatical.
Okay.
And then what was strange is that I fell in love with it, of all things. And so,
like 22.
I'm 22 at this time. Yeah. And so what was interesting though, is when I was at massage school, this particular school gave a world-class anatomy education.
Oh, cool.
So the University of Utah has one of the best anatomy programs, and they take that program and basically replicated it for this massage school. And that's where I got to meet Jonathan Bennion. He's the co-founder and co-owner for the Institute of Human Anatomy. He was my teacher.
Oh, no way.
He had just started teaching. And so I got to meet him there. And once I graduated from massage school, I came back as a teaching assistant And then that's when I actually got to hang out with him more. And when he opened the lab, brought me along, and it kind of just, it's.
So he started it after he was teaching?
He did. So, okay. How it worked was in those early days around 2010 ish, 2011 ish, the students from the massage school would go up to the University of Utah and they would get a cadaver lab. So you just get to go there, you get to see the bodies, and it would correlate with their curricula.
That's awesome for a massage school to do that. That's atypical, correct?
That's very atypical.
Yeah.
And then it became non-existent because then that relationship fell apart and there was basically riots in the hallways. And so because the students, I mean, it's not as though the students signed up solely to go to the cadaver lab, but it was a big selling point for going to school.
Sure, yeah.
And so Jonathan decided to start his own. And so he and his brother-in-law started the Institute of Human Anatomy and then just a few months later brought me along. And that's where we actually were trying to fill that gap. So we were offering the cadaver lab to massage students. And then everyone inside of the Salt Lake City area started discovering we existed. And so we started teaching EMTs, paramedics, medical assistants, dental assistants, basically anyone who doesn't have access to a cadaver lab in a university setting. So basically a lot of trade schools. A lot of just vocational schools, those that just because you don't go become a medical assistant at a university. That's more of nursing. So there's this empty space that we were able to capitalize on. And that's kind of what we did.
That's so wild, dude. So, okay. When you first started doing this, did you have any idea like how it was going to shape into what it's become today?
Not at all. Yeah. Not at all. So it was this cool thing to do on the side.
Okay.
At the time, because I was doing massage therapy, again, like I had full intention of going back to school. But what happened for I didn't know quite yet what.
Anything else?
Basically? I'm still on this sabbatical mindset.
Sure. Yeah, yeah. And I'm just doing this for fun for a little while.
And then
decompress.
But then I'm starting working in Park City. So if you're familiar with Park City, you know, it's a destination resort or resort town. And I'm getting to work with like professional athletes. Like I'm working with bobsledders because you have the Winter Olympic training facility. There's only two in the United States.
Yeah.
One's in Lake Placid and the other's in Park City. So I'm working with professional athletes. I'm making, you know, over $100 an hour. I'm just like, I'm going to hold off on school. That's my focus. And then I'm teaching at the Institute of Human Anatomy very part-time. Mm. It wasn't until what happened is how things evolved. When I say part-time, I was teaching a lab maybe once a month, once every 2 months.
Oh, wow. Okay.
And so
what were you teaching?
So what would happen is you basically have groups come in. And so if you wanted to come in, I would just ask you, like, I would wait until you got into the lab, like, what do you want to learn today? Mm. And when we get there, then we have all these what are called pro sections. So Jonathan and I, we would do most of those dissections ourselves.
Okay.
So when we get a body, it's a normal body.
Okay. Okay. But how are you getting a body? Like, how does this whole process, like, you're not just sourcing product, right? Like, you're getting human bodies that have recently deceased. So what's the process there?
It's a great question because the average person cannot go get a body.
Right? Yeah, that's what I'm saying.
Yeah, you're not going down to Home Depot and getting one. Yeah,
they're not listed on Alibaba.
No.
You can't just get them shipped in quantity to your warehouse.
So what you have to do is know the right people, as with everything. And so for us, we got approval through the University of Utah, but then it just spread to actually working with a bunch of different body donation programs throughout the United States. So this is a whole world that I don't think a lot of people are aware exists around body donation, because you have to understand universities need bodies for med students. Then you have private institutions that do research and medical research. Hmm. So like I've personally hosted plenty of medical device testing labs where you have surgeons that'll come in and perform surgeries on body donors, as opposed to actually doing that on a living patient. Mm. So experimental surgeries, new techniques, that's where they hone their craft. So there is a whole industry around this. You need bodies.
Yeah.
So every region has multiple body donation programs. Some of them are certified, some of them are uncertified. The uncertified are the sketchier ones. Mm. And that's kind of a realm I don't honestly know much about because I actively avoid that at all costs.
That's probably a good decision.
And so what we
you
do-
You probably end up being one of the cadavers.
it's not great. And so then what we do is we talk with these body donation programs. And what you do is you do have to pay some money, but you're paying the money to keep their company afloat. Right?
Are these all privatized company? Like, are these all private companies?
Some of them are. Some of them work through universities, right? So like the University of Utah is one that, you know, they're going to work at the university level. So they have like donations coming in to obviously fund the campus.
Yeah.
But some of them are completely privatized. So it just kind of depends. So that's, it really depends on who we want to work with.
You just got to know the right body dealer, basically.
You do. You do. And of course, like, so but they know who we are too, right? Because it's like, in order to the approval process for this, you have to know the right people. And because, like I said, they're not just going to give it to you just because you're like, hey, I have the skill set or starting the desire. A business. Yeah. So you have to know the right people. And that's what Jonathan did. So Jonathan and his brother-in-law who started it, that was the first like year or 2 years was figuring out, going through all the red tape of like, how do we start our own private human cadaver lab? And once you got that going, then I became the lab director. And so it was my job to kind of like handle everything once they get to the lab. So once you, when you get a body though, it's literally, you just like, you ask them, you tell them what you need, but you really only have a couple options, male or female. Hmm. And so body donors are pretty much all 55 or older, because if you're 55 or younger or 54 and younger, your organs might be viable for donation to save a life. Mm. So what that means is you got to be older. So you really are kind of limited. You can't be like, you know, you can't even really pick race, ethnicity. You really can't pick much. It's whatever is available, because whoever died, they had to get preserved or not preserved. You get the body, you just say, I want a male or a female. And then you take them back to the lab, and that's where you perform the dissections.
Yeah. What's like the time lapse between they're gone and now they're at your lab?
Depends. So it can be, I think the soonest we had was a couple days between, you know, death and then being in our lab. But there's also, because this is what's really cool, getting to work with embalmers. Embalmers are like morticians, but a little bit different, because morticians will do some embalming. But like when you're talking about embalmers working at this level, they work with chemicals that are well beyond anything you'd find in a mortuary. Because they're looking to preserve for over a decade or more. Right. Like we can keep these bodies for 10 years. So, you know, there's a lot of chemicals going in there, but in mortuary science and the embalmers, they're basically chemists.
Sorry to interrupt. I want you to keep going on that. I just want to know, does the body look different from like year one to year 10?
Depends on how much dissection's been done, and depends on how much handling, because the laws of physics still apply, right? You can only touch something so many times. Mm. And so for us, like we've had one body that for like 10 years.
Wow.
And so at that point, you know, we've estimated, well, actually it's more of mine. This is a back of the napkin calculation, but it's like, I estimate somewhere around 15 to 20,000 people have come through the lab and physically touched this one body. Wow. So it then, that breaks it down. So you get fraying, and that's what kind of separates it. But yeah, with embalmers, you know, like learning their whole craft and what's going on in these, it's a really robust process and everything that goes with it. So what I was trying to say is sometimes like the preservation process may not take. So this is a crazy thing. Like what can happen is they'll walk around and they may have to poke the bodies to see if the preservation process is happening properly. Because if it's not, you might get some decomposition. Mm-hmm. And then they have to just go ahead and cremate the body. So we're really limited. It's not only just like who died, but did the preservation process work properly?
Right.
And if it did, then we're allowed to take that body. And you pay a little bit of money just to make sure that the business is running properly.
Sure.
And we then are a steward, is the way we think of it. Like it's a very ethical and responsible renting. And so what we do is everything that is dissected is kept. So then you have like a container for that one individual body. And then what happens at the end of their time there, which we can keep them for about a decade, we take their body and whatever we've dissected back to the body donation program, and all of it gets cremated.
Can I ask how much you pay for a single body?
I don't even know that. So that's more of that's their side of the things. I mean, it's not much, but I mean, again, it's
something to keep the business. Yeah,
like exactly. You said,
still operating a business, and embalmers got to get paid.
Exactly.
So the families of the dead people that are providing these bodies, is this a decision that they're made? Like, is this like part of the paperwork or something at the mortuary? Like, how do they decide that we're going to donate this body, or do they get paid for it? Is it like a low income type thing? Is it purely donating? Like, how, What's that whole process? Because they're obviously not getting cremated and they're not getting buried. There's no open casket, and then they donate it, or maybe that's how it works. But yeah, talk me through that a little bit.
So, I mean, great questions. But it also kind of depends on each body donation program. And so I'm only familiar with the ones that we've dealt with, but they're all pretty much the same.
But who designs the program?
I mean, whoever's in charge of it. So, I mean, at the university level, whoever's running that, if it's at that, or if it's a private institution, what they'll do is, I mean, I'm sure they're working with, you know, local authorities, and, you know, there's a whole
gotta
series
be some
of
regulations.
Yeah, there needs to be. If there's not, that, I mean, I'm just not aware of at that level. Because that's the thing is, you know, since I don't do any of the embalming myself, there is a whole nature of this that I'm unaware of. But yeah. Every time I go and talk with them, I'm like a kid in a candy store asking them so many questions. And so what I've learned over the years is, the family can be the one who makes the decision, but most times it's actually the donor. And you usually at this stage, because if you're dying from a non-traumatic event, so first off, they can't have died from a traumatic event.
Okay.
Because then the cardiovascular system's compromised. And if you try to embalm them, it literally wouldn't work. The embalming preservatives would go outside the body.
Gotcha.
So you have to die under relatively normal circumstances, but that could be cancer, that could be a stroke, those types of things. But a lot of times, most of the bodies are cancer. These people know they're going to die. Mm-hmm. You have to understand, in the United States, funeral costs are, I think last time I looked into it, it's averaged between $12,000 and $14,000.
Oh, it's wild.
It's insane.
It's egregious, honestly.
It is. It is. And a lot of that's casket. And there's so much, like, that's a whole other can of worms. But they want to save on funeral costs. So most of these body donors will just make this decision to donate their body to the med school. That's how most people view it. And so then what they'll do is you sign a form of bequeathal. It's okay. My favorite word, bequeathal, to say. When you bequeath your body, when you die, your family notifies the body donation program that you have passed. They will then come and collect the body. And you have to do so within a certain period of time. I think it's usually they try to get there between 18 hours and 24 hours. Hmm. Because if not, rigor sets in, rigor mortis.
Okay.
So the body starts decomposing and the muscles get too tight and you physically can't preserve them.
Wow.
So you have a narrow window where you have to get them. So once the body is received and then they're preserved, then you can keep them. There's two options, at least with the body donor programs we work with. You could be a return to family body or you could be a common grave body. A common grave body are those that are like, I don't really have a family or I don't care for my remains to be returned to my family. Return to family, they do care. Whatever it is, at the end of your time, everything that has been dissected is taken and gets cremated. If you're a return to family body, after 2 years, you get an urn with your loved one's remains.
Oh, no shit.
If you're a common grave, then that'll usually go to a cemetery and there's going to be a location in the cemetery where that urn will be placed.
Gotcha.
So
it's when you were saying like you're leasing the body, like that you're legitimately leasing the body.
Yes.
Like you got to give it back at some point.
But here's the thing. The family can change their mind. And that's happened to us before where we had a body that we thought was common grave. We're like, oh, we get to keep this body for 10 years. The family didn't want that. And they wanted the body back right away. Mm. Totally within their right. So then we just gathered everything up and returned the body. Everything was cremated and it was given back.
That's so crazy. Okay. So let's talk about high level here. Some of the things that you've learned examining like literally the insides of the human body. It's, you know, I feel like we as a culture are generally moving into a period of being more aware of health, and hopefully it catches on a little bit more in the coming generation or two so that, you know, the obesity rate in America could go down and along with it, a lot of really elected diseases that people basically choose to do because they don't learn anything about how their body works. I'm curious, like if looking into this stuff has completely changed the way that you view how we function.
Absolutely.
As humans.
Absolutely. So there's two kind of levels to it. So for me, I mean, I've been teaching just anatomy as a science in the classroom without body donors for like 11, 12 years now.
Okay.
And I think the way I just broadly talk about anatomy, there's I call it the baseline science. It's a gateway science because there's a reason why it's taught in every healthcare field. In the first semester, no matter what, right? Hmm. No matter how you're going to treat the body, you got to know how it's built if you're going to fix it or at least attempt to.
Yeah.
But the thing, but I always describe anatomy as a very boring science too. It's literally like, at least in the classroom, it's like, this is your liver. Mm-hmm. It's brown. It produces bile. It's a science of classification. So it's inherently boring. But the thing is, once you know it, you can think of it as the what. Physiology is the how. Then you're like, okay, but how does the liver make bile? How does the liver do these things? Reason why I call it a baseline or gateway science is because the more you know about anatomy, you can't help but get curious. You're like, okay, well then how do I fuel the liver, which creates nutrition? Okay, how do the, when you learn about your muscles, you know, like base and intro and level anatomy is like, oh, this is biceps brachii, this is brachialis, all that fun stuff. But then all of a sudden, when you start asking like, well, which one moves in which movement, then you can't help but start naturally shifting towards kinesiology and exercise science. Right. So if you're able to learn anatomy just as a baseline, it's almost like learning a language. You know how, like, if you learn second language, it's easier to learn the third, the fourth, the fifth.
Yeah.
You learn anatomy, you speak the language of the body, and it becomes immensely easier. And so for me, when I started learning just anatomy in the classroom, it was the most powerful thing ever, because all of a sudden it's like, I understand what's going on. You know, I can talk to a dietitian and there's no loss of communication. I can talk to a surgeon. In fact, I've taught many surgeons when I would host those medical device labs, because surgeons, you have to understand, they're so specialized.
Yeah.
They basically just brain dump their anatomy. That's first semester med school. And then they only focus on what they need to know. So if they're ortho, you know, it's like, they know the anatomy of the back or the knee better than I do,
yeah,
but I know the anatomy of the entire body better than them. So sure. It's like, you'll talk with them. And so it's cool because anatomy is a powerful science, because it just, you can talk with anyone in the healthcare profession. It doesn't matter where they are. But working with body donors is different. With body donors, all of a sudden what you learn is you see how things work. The first time I saw a lot of visceral fat, it changes you. When you see, it's like, because we all kind of conceptually know. Like, I mean, like, before I knew anything about health, it's like, I knew McDonald's was bad, but I mean, like, I didn't know how it was bad. And then even when people tell you, that's still kind of abstract.
Sure.
Yeah. You know, but when you start seeing what real body fat looks like, when you see a fatty liver.
And a lot of people will think that they're not fat because they have a metabolism that burns fat out here. Mm-hmm. But then and for those listening that don't know visceral fats, and correct me if I'm wrong, it's the fat surrounding your organs. It's fat on the inside, essentially. And it's the most dangerous kind of fat.
Absolutely. As well. Right. Like, I mean, I'm not saying this isn't 100% accurate, but I mean, like, if you could gain weight only in the subcutaneous fat,
yeah,
I mean, things wouldn't be as bad
for you. Sure.
But the real problem is the visceral fat. So seeing cancer, I mean, there was one donor I got to dissect her breast. She had breast cancer and it looked like someone had just dropped Skittles. Right. So you're seeing like inside of the breast. And so you're able to see these things when you're able, there's knowledge that can be conveyed in the classroom, but there's something that just needs to be seen to understood. And the beautiful part for me and my students is when they see it, I don't even have to say anything. It's just, I show it and I'm like, that's cancer. And you just see it washing over them. Mm-hmm. Everyone now understands why that's bad in a way that they never could have unless they had seen it.
Yeah, which is why they in Europe put the pictures of black lungs on the outside of cigarette boxes and stuff like that, hoping it deters people, which it obviously doesn't still. But
the first, I've dissected out lung cancer from what I assume was a smoker, but they actually don't tell us that information, which is actually kind of interesting. The only thing I know about these body donors is their age and what they pass from. I don't know any of their medical history.
Oh,
so I've kind of called it Sherlock Holmesing.
Yeah.
Where it's like, I see something and I just then start kind of like deducing what could have possibly happened. You can make
reasonable assumptions based on what you're seeing.
Where was I going?
What lung cancer.
Lung cancer. Yeah. So with lung cancer, when I dissected lung cancer, so lungs are squishy. Like if I were to, I assume, grab your lungs, right? It would be nice and squishy, be like a sponge. There'd be a lot of pliability. I could move them. This was black and hard like a rock.
Wow.
And it had white spots that were all throughout it. But I mean, what was strange to me is I remember this was the first time I really asked myself, like, I couldn't understand. I understood how they died from this. I didn't understand how they were living 5 minutes before they died. Wow. You know what I mean? Like, I
was at what point did this become hard enough to actually
Like, there's this
to stop
thing.
Functioning.
It just doesn't compute.
Yeah.
And you can see this with all sorts of health, right? All sorts of things. And so when people die of different things, when I get to see those, you just start to understand what living does as a toll on the body. Even things like strokes, even like there's all sorts of things that may not necessarily be that they weren't making optimal choices. Sometimes it's just the way that, you know, it's the luck of the draw.
Sure.
But that kind of stuff is extremely powerful. And so what it, for me, what it's done is it's made me, I can't justify poor health choices.
Sure. Yeah.
You know, like while I may have known McDonald's was bad, it's like I was when I never knew how, now I know.
Right.
There's just, and that's
when you're carving out visceral fat from organs.
You just know. Yeah.
And or so holding a black lung. Yeah, it's hard to justify smoking the cigarette.
Exactly.
What about cirrhosis of the liver? Like, is there, like, is that something that you can tell pretty immediately?
So I haven't seen cirrhosis in our lab. So coming through, but, you know, from my understanding, I have seen images of it, and you can. I mean, the name itself actually means red, orange, yellow liver. And so it's all bulgy and it'll be discolored. So you'd be able to see that. So cirrhosis, though, that's end game of liver failure. So I've seen fatty liver, like alcoholic fatty liver disease, and that is still deformed. It looks strange.
So that's before it becomes cirrhosis is what it would. So that's like the gradual.
Exactly. Yes. Cirrhosis is end game. When you're, when you have a when your liver is in that, I don't know if cirrhotic is the right now, but it, I think everyone understands what I'm saying.
Yeah.
When you're at that stage, that's when you're headed towards liver failure. So there's stages before that that are still, you're in trouble. It looks different.
It's for sure. Like alert, alert, please alter course immediately type of a thing.
Yes. Yeah.
Well, let's talk about a couple of those things. I want to talk to you about the brain a little bit as well, but, let's talk about start with alcohol. Let's go through some vices here and just roll through, you know, their effect on the body.
Sure.
What happens when you're actually drinking liquor? How bad is it really for you?
Yeah. So, you know, this is one of our most popular videos that we did was on alcohol. And what's funny is when I did that video, I didn't even, you always hope the video is going to do well.
Yeah.
But that was one of the first videos that surprised me in how well it actually did. But in hindsight, it's like, of course it did well. It's alcohol.
Yeah.
So alcohol, it really just, there's so many factors that go into it. So when you consume alcohol, it can be absorbed somewhat in your mouth. So, you know, it's like, think like wine tasters, right? As they're just sloshing it around. They can actually absorb some small amounts. It gets absorbed in your stomach, which is why your stomach will actually feel warm. But not a lot. Most of it gets absorbed in the small intestine. But when it goes to the liver, it's going to be converted with some enzymes essentially into fat. And whatever doesn't get converted into fat makes it in the bloodstream. And that's where things start. It starts, you know, manipulating the mind and different your neurochemistry. But you are going to have fat that is going to be created inside of the liver just based off of metabolism. And it just stresses everything out. I mean, it affects your kidneys. It affects, obviously, your liver. It affects your brain. I mean, we're talking, it's global. It affects your muscle tissue, you know, and that's something that a lot of people don't understand.
How so?
It can actually interfere with protein synthesis. So I'll say, like, if you go to the gym and then you drink later that day, I'm not saying you're going to negate any gains, all the gains, but you are going to negate some of those gains. We know that it actually interferes with that, the protein synthesis. So it's, so it's global, you know, because you have to understand, this is the thing that a lot of people don't think of, is we know it affects the brain, but it gets to the brain by going through the bloodstream, and the bloodstream is literally everywhere. So the alcohol is affecting your toes. It's affecting
your joints,
everything. Now, some things are going to be worse than others. And so, I don't pretend to be, you know, have read all the literature. I don't know how much investigation has been done. It's like, how does alcohol affect your knees?
I don't know
how much has been done, if any, on those levels.
But it's not helping them.
It's not helping them. It is definitely not helping them at all.
Yeah. How negatively does it affect your brain? Like, is like, what type of long term, obviously it affects your brain immediately, your mind, but like, how does it affect your, does it affect your brain physically long term?
So that's the thing. Since making that video, which is really in, which is really fantastic, is that a lot of video, not a lot of videos, a lot of research has come out showing the detrimental effects of alcohol. And one of the big ones is neurodegeneration. So the gray matter, which is the outer cortex, it's the outer surface of your brain. It's very thin. I forget the exact what it is in millimeters, but I mean, it's very, very thin. It actually gets smaller. It shrinks when you, even if you drink one drink a week. I can't remember exactly how much it does, but I mean, you can just play that game of what is this going to be like when you do this chronically, right? And whether that chronically is just, okay, what drink every day, this, that, or the other. But neurodegeneration. So what that's going to do is it's going to impact your cognitive health. You're not going to be able to focus as well. You're not going to be able to, your neuroplasticity is going to go down. So you're not going to be able to adapt to situations as well as you once could. It's going to affect everything because your brain is everything. So, I mean, is it going to affect your hearing as in like you're getting hearing loss? No, but it could actually impact your ability to process sounds optimally. So it's just going to have, you're going to have shrinkage in the brain. And that is still something we're working out to see exactly how bad is that.
Sure.
That's something we need more time, but we can definitely see it.
Yeah. It's wild to me, dude, because alcohol is one of those things that seem it seems like we just accepted it as a culture a long time ago when it's just one of the worst things that we can do. And to be clear, I still drink because it's fun, but also I, you know, don't binge drink for those reasons. And I frankly am just like trying to cut back more and more and more because of all of those reasons. It's like, it seems like that's going to be like, it's going to be like smoking at some point. Where we as a society at some point are just going to be like, remember when everybody used to drink all the time, you know, remember, like just like we talk about cigarettes. Remember everybody used to light up like, you know, outside the church, you know, in the restaurants, at the airport, in the office, there's cigarettes everywhere. You know, that was not that long ago.
Yeah.
I feel like probably in the next 30, 40, 50 years, it's eventually the more data comes out, I guess, you know, or the as soon as people start living to 120, 130, 140 years old, and we start realizing that there's actually, you know, we're capable of doing so much more. I feel like that's going to be one of those things that we kind of look back on and we're like, oh, that was kind of dumb.
I completely agree with you. I mean, I quit drinking, but it's funny. It's like, it's not because I felt like I had a problem or anything. It was just that I got tired of feeling terrible and that it was just that simple. And I've loved it. Like there's not like, to me, it's more like I think of drinking in the same way that I think of ice cream, where it's like some days it's like, that'd be nice to have some ice cream.
Yeah. Yeah.
But I almost never actually go get the ice cream and then you just give it a little bit of time. But you know, I understand why people do it because I mean, I drank for years. I mean, I'm a Marine, like drinking is in my blood.
Yeah, for sure.
So, but I think I understand exactly what you're saying. I really believe that'll be the case. And I only expect us to find worse results the more we look into alcohol. Because, and this is something I said in that video, this was about 3 or 4 years ago now that I made it. I'm like, it's poison. And we all know it's poison in the same way that
we're not under the pretense.
We know McDonald's is bad. I mean, so it's just now we're figuring out how bad it really is.
Yeah. Well, this is depressing. all right. So let's move on to the next vice. Let's talk vaping. Versus smoking. It's obviously fairly well documented that smoking is pretty bad for you. Vaping's the new thing. And now there's kids, dude, like just kids. They're like 11 walking around with freaking vapes. Gotta assume it's not good for you either. So let's talk through some of the effects that vaping might have on you.
So vaping is, so there's a difference in types of vape that, we have learned this because, so Jonathan made a few videos on vaping, and if you want to agitate a community, make a video demonizing vaping. They are very passionate because there is nicotine type vaping, and then there's cannabis, and then you have regulated versus unregulated. And to me, I think we're just splitting hairs here. And at the end of the day, they're all going to be bad. Yes, it's on a spectrum, right? I think there's no disagreement. Like the unregulated THC cartridge you got from the trunk of a car, you know, in a Denny's parking lot. Yes, okay. That is going to be the worst cartridge, okay? But at the end of the day, your lungs evolved to inhale oxygen, nitrogen. That's pretty much it, and exhale carbon dioxide. There are vapors that are going in there, obviously that's in its name, that we just don't have long-term studies. So what we do know is with THC-based cartridges, something called EVOLI, I forget off the top of my head what EVOLI stands for, but EVOLI is destroying lungs. Mm. We've seen data around popcorn lung. Popcorn lung got its name based around movie theater popcorn. And workers, the fumes actually destroying parts of their alveoli, the distalmost sacs inside of their lungs based off those fumes. So to me, it's like, I think this is about as common sense as it is. Look, I'll be honest. I used to smoke cigarettes when I was in the Marine Corps.
Yeah.
I used to justify that like crazy. You know, like, I know it's bad for me, but I could stop it. Like, I know the mentality of smokers, mm-hmm. and I know the mentality of vapers is the same thing, even mm-hmm. if they don't want to pretend. They want to pretend that it's different.
Yeah.
At the end, they're justifying it. I think everyone knows that it's more likely it's bad for you than it isn't. Mm. But the thing that they're holding their hat on is that we don't have a ton of long-term data. But the data we are having come in is suggesting that, yes, there are definitely problems. It's affecting the sacs. So these alveoli, these are really tiny. These are microscopic little sacs. That's the very end of the bronchial tubes. So when you breathe in, that's where air stops and it meets the bloodstream. Those are somewhat getting destroyed or losing elasticity.
These are in your lungs?
These are in your lungs. Okay. So they're losing elasticity. You're seeing in some cases, you know, again, it depends on, we'd have to ask, what is the vape? What are they smoking or inhaling? Things that are similar to like emphysema, COPD, so chronic obstructive pulmonary disease. Mm. There's all sorts of little incidents, but we just don't have long-term data. But I think anyone who is assuming this is going to be fine, that they could do this all day, every day until they're 90 and assume they'll be fine, I think they're deluding themselves.
And the substance is basically irrelevant, whether it's THC or nicotine or whatever it is. It's pretty much irrelevant.
Yeah, they're all going to affect you differently because in order to, THC is going to, it's a different molecule, right, than nicotine is. Mm-hmm. So you have to have different carrier molecules. Yeah, there's different things, there's different subtleties, and those are going to interact with the body. And there's no question that what it seems like is unregulated THC cartridges are very bad. Mm. But at the end of the day, you still are inhaling things with the nicotine. Sure. Nicotine itself is not that bad.
Yeah.
So it depends.
I've heard that it's actually not, that's actually pretty good in some
exactly.
cases.
But the problem is it's also very easy to abuse. And so, I mean, this is where we just have to be honest with ourselves and see it and say like, okay, is it worth it? Is it worth the effort or the risk that's coming with it? And for me, it's like, I don't see why you'd really go down that realm.
Yeah.
If you don't have to.
What about smoking weed, like smoking flower versus a vape or smoking flower versus smoking a cigarette?
It's awful for you. Smoking anything.
Yeah.
Because I mean,
anything you inhale into your lungs besides oxygen.
The way I always put it is it's like you're lighting something on fire right in front of your face and inhaling it.
Yeah.
That's not good for you. Mm-hmm. Smoke, there are many different kinds of smoke and they all matter differently, but they're all bad for you. And we know this. So it's like if someone were to like, I'm not in the habit of giving medical advice, but if someone were to just like ask like, Justin, like what's your preference scale?
Yeah.
Right. Like obviously like vaping.
Yeah. Well, it's like alcohol, right? Like no alcohol is good for you, but tequila is probably like the best one.
Exactly.
You know, if we're going to make if we're forcing me to pick like good alcohol, it's probably the clear tequila is probably best.
Exactly. So that's where I'm at is, vaping is going to be the best one more out of those typical, but with smoking is like, okay, smoking a cigar, how's that going to be different? Because if you inhale the cigar smoke, that's going to be very bad for you. Well, you shouldn't be inhaling the cigar smoke, but this is where you start getting like all these little nuances. And I'm not in the habit of fighting with the community in my comment section. But I read those comments and you can see that like when I did a video talking about this very thing about how all smoke is bad, I don't care what it's coming from. It's bad for you. The amount of pushback I got from cigar smokers was intense because they are just out there like, well, you shouldn't be doing that. And I'm like, I get it. But I mean, do you really think like no smoke, like not even a little bit of smoke is getting into your lungs?
Right.
It's all very bad for you. It destroys it again, COPD. So emphysema, chronic obstructive pulmonary disease. It's going to create, bronchitis.
Yeah.
You are literally inhaling hot at like fumes into your lungs, it's going to destroy them.
Is there, so let's do the fake scale thing here. So we're talking, like smoking cigarettes, probably all the way, like worst thing you could do. Mm. What would be the best thing if you're picking one of those vices?
picking one of those vices.
Like cigar smoke, assuming you're not inhaling cigar smoke, you're doing it properly, you're smoking in the mouth, or like smoking, you know, a joint, or smoking a vape, or like where do you put all these things on this kind of?
I would probably put it at
bad to worst spectrum.
That's a really good question. I don't want to, it's not that I need to do a robust comparative analysis or anything like that, but I mean, like, I bet I get
some views though if you did.
Right, probably. I would probably put it and rank it. I'd say probably THC. It's a toss up, because I mean, like, I'm also a fan of THC and CBD, mm-hmm. and I am really interested
of the compounds
of
themselves.
Yeah. I'm very much interested in them. I'm very interested in psychedelics as a whole. Mm. And while THC doesn't really classify as a psychedelic, I really am optimistic about a lot of things mm-hmm. with it. So that might be affecting my bias with it.
Okay.
But at the same time, I would definitely put it in vaping. So whether it's nicotine or vaping, those are probably going to be the best.
Vaping would be better than smoking.
100%.
Okay.
100%. But I mean, there could be a study that comes out next week. And sure. And I'm just like, oh,
that,
yeah.
Obliterates,
yeah.
That. Yeah,
that makes sense. Right.
Well, it doesn't bode well for my cigar smoking either. But, you know, some of those vices, man, like sometimes I'm just like, you know what? I know this is bad for me, but I enjoy this so much.
You don't have to be, you know what I mean? Exactly. You don't have to be perfect. And yeah. I'm not.
And nobody's vice free, you know?
Exactly.
And like, if you tell me you are, you know.
That you're lying.
Yeah. There's something you're hiding.
Yeah. This is never, for me, it's never been about passing judgment. It's merely just kind of just educating. That's all it
sure.
is.
Like, yeah, yeah.
Like, I am all about personal agency. Make your own choices. Well,
also, the frustrating part, I'm sure from your end, is just like seeing the like desperate justification from people who want to feel good about it.
Yeah.
Instead of just admitting that it's just, all right, yeah, it's not good for me, but I'm going to smoke a cigar.
Exactly. And that's the thing. Honestly, the best comments I've seen come from cigarette smokers because they all understand it's bad.
Like, there's no talking your way out of that one.
Yeah, they're just like, look, we do it because, you know, we want to be rebels. And I'm like, okay, you know who you are. That's all good
for you.
It's all
good. Oh, man. Is there like a frequency, like, so asking from me being a cigar smoker, if you're smoking 3 cigars a day, that's got to be a difference between smoking 1 cigar a month, right? I mean, do you know any of the data on that?
I did it at one point, but I don't remember at this point. Just understand, like, put it this way. You have a turnover rate for cells called epithelial cells inside of your mouth, inside of your throat. And it can take a few days to a couple weeks, depending on the type of cell and the exact location. Just think, like, even if you're inhaling and puffing on that cigar, you're destroying the epithelium that are on your teeth, on the roof of your mouth, on your tongue. Those are just getting bombarded, right? So that's going to take a little bit of time for them to fully replicate, well, regenerate and get to where they, that'll take a couple days. It also just depends on the type of cigar, right? I mean, is this a full blown Cuban, you know, like that you imported?
Sure.
When you shouldn't have, you know, it, like, we, there is nuances to this.
Because it also matters, like, what kind of chemicals are wrapped in the tobacco leaves and like the additive. That's what kind of, from my understanding, makes cigarettes worse than basically anything else, right? Is like just the additives and the chemicals and the other shit they put in there that's not tobacco.
Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely.
Well, again, we're ruining most of my life here, but let's keep going down this rabbit hole because it's fun. I want to talk nootropics, mainly because Magic Mind is sending me these boxes, and I've really enjoyed them. Have you taken these before?
I haven't. No.
You want to try one?
Let's do it.
Yeah.
It was cold.
I like them refrigerated. They sent me a formula the first time, and I was not a big fan, and so we didn't end up doing anything. And then they sent me another box and changed the formula up a little bit. And I was like, oh, that's actually a really tasty shot. So the reason I take these is for like focus mode, you know. So I take them a lot before podcast interviews because I enjoy. Like I feel a difference. Like if we take these right now in like 20 minutes, you know, I feel a shift in my cognitive performance, I think.
Yeah.
So I take them because I think it makes me a little bit sharper. And then there's nootropics. It's a matcha shot, but there's adaptogens, a bunch of vitamins in there for immunity. And then I think stuff like cordyceps and different things like that that they put in this. But yeah,
21 calories. That's not bad.
Yeah. Yeah. I think there's actually like 30, 40 milligrams of caffeine as well, if you're cool with caffeine.
No, I am.
Okay.
Yeah, cool. I like it. I'm good. All right. Let's try it.
So let's talk nootropics. How Have you seen any research on these or data on these, or like, you know, to the extent of them actually working to improve cognitive performance?
You know, I know there definitely are. Like, I've looked, it's been a couple of years since I did any real good deep research. And most of that research was around some of the big players that a lot of people are familiar with. Like, we're talking theanine, magnesium threonate, apigenin. These ones, I'm really liking ones that are helping me with sleep and okay. anything along those lines. When it comes to like actually like boosting cognitive performance, I'm not that educated on that as okay. much as I want to. Like, for me, it's like I'm much more educated on the science of what you'd see in different states. Like, what is an alpha state? What is a theta state? Those types of things.
Okay.
I remember from what I was looking at before years ago, it didn't impress me all that much, but that's not to say that it wasn't valuable.
Sure.
But I mean, like, I guess like in my head, a lot of the thoughts that I had with nootropics is I'm like, oh, I'm going to take this and this is going to just blow my mind. You know, I want this reishi mushroom or this lion's mane. I mean, yeah. like I've experimented with
those
them.
Are in here as well.
I love lion's mane. So when it comes to fungus, I'm actually a very big fan.
Okay.
So like, you know, your reishi mushrooms, your lion's mane mushrooms. I can't remember for the life of me off the top of my head why they're so great. Yeah. I know I think lion's mane has to do with, myelination. So like you have neurons, which are the cells that send signals, mm-hmm. they are wrapped in fat. Okay. And the more fat they're wrapped in, the faster and more efficient they are. And I believe lion's mane helps thicken that fat. So I mean, it can help with performance, cognitive performance and things of that nature. So it's like, there are definitely some that are well understood, mm-hmm, mm-hmm. but I'm not as educated on them as I wish I was.
Yeah, I like these ones, man. These are probably my favorite ones I've ever tried. So I'm happy for that. They keep sending me boxes, and I'm happy to send some people over to them. And
let's do it.
Cheers.
Oh, that's good. Actually, that tastes good.
It's not bad, right?
That's good.
Yeah.
For a second, I was thinking with the green, I was like, this is probably gonna wheatgrass or something.
Yeah. No, there was
that's really good.
Actually. Another company sent me some stuff one time, and I tried it. And I was just like, I can't endorse this, guys. Like, I'm sorry. Like, I'm sure it's really good for me, but there's no way I'm going to drink this every day.
No, I know how that goes. I mean, like, there's been so many sponsors that even like I get excited for ahead of time, and then I try it. And there was one, I wouldn't say the name of the company, but I don't remember the name of the company. It was some kind of honey. And I love honey. I take honey all the time. I give it to my kids when we're sick. Like, it made me ill. It made me ill. But like, I'm giving it to my whole family, all these other people I'm giving it to, and they love it.
Really?
And I'm just sitting there like, well, I can't endorse it though.
Right,
because like,
right.
maybe I'm just, there's something with my genetics, but
yeah. It's the whole Vitamita Vegemin, I Love Lucy skit.
Exactly.
You know what I mean? You're trying to say that it looks good or that it tastes good while you're like, throwing up in your mouth.
Exactly.
Like, I can't do this, guys.
Exactly.
I'm sorry.
Exactly.
So yeah, thanks to Magic Mind for sending me a bunch of this stuff. If you want to go try Magic Mind for yourself, you can go to magicmind.com/Jan, as in January, J-A-N, Jan Travis, and then use code Travis20. You're going to get $75 off your order when you subscribe for a 3-month supply of Magic Mind. So magicmind.com/Jan Travis and use code Travis20 if you want to try this nootrop. It's my favorite one. I use them all the time. And if you're a podcaster, I think you owe it to yourself and to your audience to take these before you do any of your episodes or recording your content. I genuinely believe it actually really, really helps. So, thanks for indulging my my questions on nootropics. And then before we're talking about that, we were talking about the full spectrum of things. And then we mentioned that you're actually a fan of THC and CBD, but like smoking's probably not the best way. So what about stuff like edibles, you know, like gummies or cookies, brownies, whatever, like is it okay to consume in those forms? And if so, are they all kind of created equal, or is there a preferred choice or method of consumption?
So, I mean, great question. Easy to answer. Are they all, I mean, at the end of the day, it's still butter. You know, it's still a cookie. You know, you have to ask like, what else are you eating? You know, how's that going to affect your blood sugar and all sorts of those types of questions are still going to be baked into it. So in that sense, it's like, I think a gummy would probably be better than eating, say, like a miniature pizza those lines. But it's, you know, a lot of it also just comes down to how effective was you know, the mixture or the mixing between the THC and the carrier molecules. So it's like butter is a really good one just because, you know, it's able to bind all the fat and it's just really awesome and really dense. But then if you cook with that butter, you're spreading it out. So then it's like, I mean, if you're eating pure butter,
a spoonful of butter, baby.
It's going to be fun. It's going to be a fun day. but you know, I'm a huge fan of edibles because, you know, again,
clip. That's it. We're done.
There it is.
One vice has slipped through.
Exactly.
We're allowed to take edibles.
There's definitely risk when it comes to THC, and that's the same risk that comes with any kind of psychedelic. And if someone has a history of mental illness, you know, in their family, they have to take these things very seriously. It's not something for me. It's like I am not a fan of recreational drug use in most cases. But I also understand that this is life and this is what people are going to do.
Sure.
And so for me, it's like if it was between alcohol and THC, then okay, it's always going to be THC. But even then, you still need to do your research if you can. Yeah. I'm not saying you have to be a scientist and out there and just like really figuring this stuff out. But at the end of the day, it's like if you have a history of mental illness in your family, taking very powerful edibles may be a very, very bad idea. You know, schizophrenic episodes have been known to show, psychoses have been known to show up. It's not obscenely common, but it's common enough that it's something you should be aware of if you have a family history of these types of things.
Is that exclusive to THC or does that exist also with other like psychedelics, MDMA?
Very common with psychedelics. Very common with psychedelics, which is why it's like for me in my mind, it's again, this isn't medical advice, but this is just saying if you're going to do these things, you need to do them responsibly. Because if you do them responsibly, there's a lot of power in these things.
Sure.
And what really interests me about THC and CBD is not just like if you go get your, you know, like for me, I'm from Salt Lake City, Utah. We have it. It's not recreationally available, but I can get my medical card and I do have my medical card. So I'm a card carrying cannabis user. They're really talking about all of the benefit, the physical benefits. Oh, it's going to do this for your blood pressure and all that, which is great. I'm most interested in cognitive benefits, in things around what they've been able to show around relaxing, anti-nausea, anti-anxiety, helping with PTSD. These types of things are what really fascinate me. And that's why I'm such a big fan of THC and the various different cannabinoids. And edibles just seem like a great way to do it. Yeah. You know, I mean, you can chop it up. You can get really scientific with it. You can know exactly how much you're getting with it as opposed to smoking it or vaping can even be really hard to tell. So I just like how it's packaged. I think it makes a ton of sense.
What about negative effects of THC? If you're taking THC over a long period of time, in edible form even, does it have, like, is there brain cell degradation, things like that?
That's a good question. I would have to look and see. Not the last time I looked, there wasn't anything that was overly convincing.
Okay.
I wouldn't be surprised if we find something down the road.
Yeah.
But
now that's becoming more like less taboo, obviously.
That's the thing. I mean, like you as a body, as a human, as an organism, are a very complex set of systems. And so when people, we need to not be as surprised when things end up being worse for us. Right.
Especially if they're fun.
Exactly. You know what
I mean? Like, pretty much all fun things.
I assume most fun things are bad for exactly. me. So
it's a proper assumption.
But at the same time, you know, we've been talking about this ad nauseum. It can be worse for you. It can be not as bad for you. So for me, it's the detrimental effects, definitely habit forming. We know that. We know it affects things like work ethic and focus and things of that nature. Mm-hmm. So it's like if you're trying to accomplish something, maybe doing it, you know, with THC is not the best way to go.
Yeah.
They've shown like it's not nearly as valuable for creativity as people like to think. You know, I know for my own cannabis use, like I feel like I'm having a lot of great ideas and then I write them down or I talk them out. And then I look at it when I'm sober and I'm like, that's a bad idea. You know, that's not going to do that. It's almost that like it helps
even
make me.
Sense. Yeah, you know? Don't even know what I was trying to say there.
And if it does help at times with people, that's great. But there's been research that's shown that, you'd probably come up with that idea regardless of the cannabis without the THC. But at the same time,
I feel like people have almost like rituals. And to me, it's like, that's really probably is more credited for the idea than the substance that you're on. Like, you know what I'm saying? Like you're not most of the time, just if you're somebody who likes to be creative when you're high or whatever, like you're not just doing some sort of brainless activity. You're like watching TV or whatever and coming up with ideas. You're probably going for a walk in nature, or you're like journaling or writing stuff down, or like you're typing out a manuscript, or, you know, if you're an author, or you're painting, or you're drawing, or you're doing graphic design or something, there's some sort of like ritualistic aspect that I think maybe that triggers you to get into a flow state quicker and allows you to be more creative. But you've kind of like deemed it as like the substance that does it to you, when it's probably just like a combination of multiple effects that get you into flow state a little bit quicker.
I completely agree with you. Like, yeah, I think you nailed it. And that's like, for me, I know like my best ideas come for me when I go on long walks.
Same.
Like, I just go on long walks.
Yeah.
And so there's been many times like I would purposefully take THC, and sure, I'm having great ideas, but I feel like I'm always having great ideas. Mm. And I came to find that I couldn't remember my ideas that I had with the THC as well as I could if I didn't. So
that's true.
You know, it's, I don't take it for those reasons. Sure. I'm not using it for ideation or any kind of the creative processes. And yeah, I'm very big on creative processes and understanding those. And so if it did help me, I'd be first in line. I'd be I'd be like, let's go. Let's go.
Yeah. What about CBD versus THC?
Yeah. So CBD has a lot more on a lot of the different cannabinoids other than THC. I'm not saying they're snake oil. Okay. I'm just saying they have a snake oil feel to them more so than THC does. I know, like, for me sitting in that like doctor's office, and you know, like they have this huge chart and they're showing you all these different, like, this cannabinoid does this, and all these different things. And I look in the research and I don't see a lot of that, or in any really overly convincing manner. Mm. I would not be surprised if there's a lot of placebo attached to it.
Yeah.
But maybe that's still helpful to people. I'm not saying they aren't helpful. I'm just saying it's not nearly as impressive to me. Mm. And the data has not been overly impressive. I know I would get pushback, like, especially in this community. And I'm not trying to talk down on it. I'm just saying what I've seen.
Sure.
And so I'm not that into the cannabinoids outside of THC.
Okay.
But if they are good for me, awesome, because I like to consume both of them together.
Well, there's not a lot of like negative, like if you're, you know, rubbing CBD balm on your sore shoulder, it's not like it's going to make it worse.
Exactly. You know? Like, that to me, like when I started seeing CBD balm at 7-Eleven as I'm checking out, I knew something was wrong. I was like, this is we've officially,
that's not where science goes. This is officially, thrive this is officially, the counter of 7-Eleven with the boner pills.
Exactly. And all, yeah. Right next to it. They're right next to it. So I knew something had gone really wrong.
Oh yeah. Man, that's actually a pretty fair point. Yeah. It's the company you keep, man. You
exactly.
okay, let's talk the YouTube side for a second. Let's talk the creator side. Whose idea was it to get on YouTube?
So, you know, it's an interesting story. To get on YouTube was all of our idea. To get on TikTok, which happened right beforehand, was more so my idea.
Okay.
So basically what happened, this will go really fast with this. I was teaching at a school. That school closed down.
Okay.
Their student population dipped down and they couldn't do it. I found myself needing to pay the bills. I was working very part-time at the Institute of Human Anatomy. And so I started getting into side hustles like we all do. Mm-hmm. You know, I'm desperately Googling.
Yeah.
You know, like, how do I make money real fast? And
right.
I stumbled into digital marketing, as so many people do, mm-hmm. social media mm-hmm. marketing agency. And I started looking into Instagram. And that's when I had this idea of maybe we could make cadaver videos. But this was back in 2019. Instagram had IGTV, which floundered, did terrible for many different reasons. But I had this, I was like, man, I think video would be really good for us, but Instagram wasn't good at it at this time. Instagram mm-hmm. was Instagram
yeah.
and YouTube was where we wanted to be, but I knew YouTube was going to be pretty competitive. And then one of my former students mentioned TikTok, and I had been familiar with TikTok, but I had like kind of like not thought about it that hard.
Yeah.
And then as soon as she said it, I was like, that's what I want to do. So what I did is I reached out to TikTok because at this time, TikTok is not the juggernaut it is today at all. There's basically only, this is early 2019. So there's just kids dancing and prank videos.
Yeah.
So what I do is I actually send a message. I film a test video in vertical format, 9x16. And I send that to ByteDance, the parent company of TikTok, because mm-hmm. I couldn't find a contact inside of TikTok. They, in 2 hours, TikTok emailed me back.
Wow.
And this is when they have no educators on the platform. They have nobody. They're like, we want you on this platform. Yeah. And so I got on a phone call with them.
No
and
way.
So wow. I was immediately talking with a growth strategist there. And they were like, we would love to work with you and get your content on the platform. Hmm. And so I worked with TikTok for the next couple months, figuring out how to do this. Now, we had wanted to go online as the Institute of Human Anatomy for years, but we just didn't have a lot of time to devote to it. Hmm. And it was mainly thinking around making digital courses. And we knew we'd have to be part of social media in some way, but like, sure, none of us were thinking, oh, we're going to be TikTokers, we're going to be YouTubers. That was not on our radar. It was more like just we were going to do the normal thing. But when I posted the first TikTok, this was November 4th, 2019, it went viral immediately. So all of a sudden I call the guys and I'm like Jonathan and his brother-in-law, and I'm like, hey guys, we're viral. We got together, and every video within that first week, we got close to like 50 million views just immediately.
Each video?
Not each video, total, but in total, but there was a couple that like eventually they had like 35, 40 million views on TikTok.
Wow.
And it never stopped. So I know like for every other creator on the planet, it's a grind. Yeah. It wasn't for us. Yeah. It was just like all of a sudden we found ourselves here.
Do you think that TikTok had a hand in that?
Kind of, but not as much as as many people probably would guess.
Yeah.
Because like we talked with them. So what they did, they actually did limit me. Okay. Well, I shouldn't say me. They limited us, because what happened was the videos were doing too well. And so all of a sudden the TikTok app updated, and then our videos weren't doing as well. And the creator growth strategists were like, well, it did seem like they were getting to some viewers that didn't want to see it. Mm. TikTok had to like shift the algorithm.
Because
of us and how we were sending these videos. But that's why I contacted them, right? Because we didn't want to send these cadaver videos to kids. That was the thing that was constantly in my head. I was like, I don't want dance video, human heart, dance video. Like, I was like, that's not going to be great for kids. Right. But at the same time, our lab is located in a high school technical institute. Hmm. So kids from all around the district come in, they do physics labs, robotics labs, they have a cadaver lab. Hmm. So I know that it's going to be okay. I just wanted to do it appropriately. And so that's why we contacted TikTok and did it through that. But they ended up shifting it down, or at least throttling it a bit. But they never boosted it, to my understanding. They never did anything like that. It was pure organic reach. But you have to understand, no one was doing anything.
No competition.
Like this. There's zero competition at this time. And so then as soon as that hit, that's when we're like, okay, let's move to Instagram. Let's move to YouTube.
Yeah.
And we just started that process. So YouTube was something we just naturally shifted into because we felt like we needed to. YouTube and TikTok and Instagram, those are completely different realms. And we had to learn it all.
And YouTube now is like close to 7 million subscribers.
6.9 right? today. 6.9 million. I think it's like 6.9 four, something like that. So it's about to be 7 million.
We'll cross 7 million in the next few days probably.
Yeah. So, I mean, it's been a journey to figure out, because you have to figure out short form and long form, which, I mean, I'm sure you understand, are completely different things.
Wildly different.
Like, right. I mean, like they have a lot of similarities, but for us, you know, it's just going viral overnight. And I think that's one of the hard things is when there wasn't a grind, all of a sudden you just find yourself like, I got to pull myself up by my bootstraps. You're constantly behind.
You have to increase expertise faster, or else people will like leave the funnel. You know,
that first year was intense, because that also we transitioned right into COVID. And when we hit COVID, we were one of the only medical educators on TikTok, and TikTok asked us to help. So I was now producing 2 TikToks per day as part of a campaign. This is when TikTok did help us. Hmm. And they were pushing our videos out to people to educate, because everyone was at home.
Yeah.
So I'm making 2 TikToks a day. I'm also the editor for all mine and Jonathan's videos for YouTube. Yeah. I've never edited before, so I'm having to learn how to edit. So I made 600 TikToks short forms in just a couple months.
Wow.
For TikTok, while also learning how to do Premiere Pro, how to do Audition, how to do all this kind of equipment, how to film, also while researching my own videos, the deep science of it. I'm working 12 hours a day for that first year. It was just absolute madness to learn how to be a creator, because again, there was no grind. It was just like, I have to know this now. I needed to know this yesterday.
Right.
So it was pretty rough.
Well, now I mean, I have to assume this has got to be a major line item on your P&L now, your YouTube revenue. I mean, your videos get crazy views.
It's true. But I also will say, who would have ever thought that human body donors are not the most attractive for things for advertisers. So CPMs and RPMs for our channel are far lower than they would be for anyone else. I don't want to sit there and say like it's not that we're able to keep the doors open. Able to do those things, but any comparative channel, like I remember I was talking with a bunch of creators at VidCon. At VidCon this last year. And when we're I was almost just, I got so depressed when I'm talking with like how much smaller they were. And I mean this respectfully, but how much more they were making. I was just like, this is, it's not cool. That's but brutal. At the end of the day, you know, I mean, and I know this sounds kind of almost like trite, but I mean, we're not doing it for the money. Yes, we like the money.
Of course.
You want that to be there. But at the end of the day, it's like we are educators first.
Yeah.
So it's like, it's never been like so bothersome. But at the same time, it is frustrating.
But also, it's got to bring other business to the Institute.
Oh, absolutely. Right?
Like,
absolutely.
I mean, the business development piece of it has to be insane.
Well, I mean, like, when we started popping off, everyone from around the world started contacting us. Hmm. And I mean that. Like, I mean, I had a conversation with someone who was a direct representative of the CCP, the Chinese Communist Party, who was trying to get our content baked into China's like entire schooling program. We didn't have any online courses to give them. So it was kind of like, we'll touch base later.
Yeah. Right.
But I mean, like when the CCP is reaching out to you, I mean, like it's literally everywhere.
Yeah.
That's the thing. It's the opportunities that come.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't think anyone's really surprised by the amount of opportunities that come with just how interested everyone is.
It is an opportunity magnet. That's for sure. Especially when it does that well.
Yeah.
Well, listen, dude, is there anything kind of closing here? Any like biggest takeaways that you've had on human existence, human life, like when you get that zoomed in, has it helped you kind of zoom out, get a broader perspective on life, on happiness, on fulfillment, on any of those things? Sometimes I find like the more you get into like the weeds on stuff like that, is it gives you a fresh perspective on how we, like why we're here and how we're here and stuff.
Yeah, 100%. I often tell people that you can't help, when you're working with the dead, you can't help but reflect on life.
Hmm.
And that's in all aspects. So I am constantly confronted with my own mortality. I'm very understanding that this can all go away at any time. And that is on the forefront of my mind. But it's not in this depressing way. It's not as though like I have some existential fear that I'm just like an asteroid's going to hit us or I'm going to die at any moment. It's just more so I have found myself since working with body donors living far more in the moment, which is, you know, the thing that every single guru will tell you to do. It's not that I, you know, have done the meditative work really to pull that off. It's more so just that, and you see this with anyone who works with the dead, you see this with first responders, you see this with military members. It's just when you are constantly, or more so than you should be, exposed to these types of things, you can't help it. And for me, it's helped me make better decisions in life. It's helped me just kind of stay more grounded with things. I feel like, I don't know, it's been beneficial to my soul. You know, if anything, it's you can't help it. You can't help but just always be thinking, you know, like, this is amazing. It's great to work with these. This could end at any moment. I'm just grateful to be here. It's been my big takeaway.
Well, dude, Justin, thanks so much for coming out, man. This is a lot of fun. Yep. I mean, if you guys are watching this, checking this out, obviously go check out what Institute of Human Anatomy is doing over on YouTube, TikTok, Instagram, everything else. You can see a bunch of very, very interesting content with cadavers, dead bodies, and see what human anatomy is all about. There was a fascinating one I was watching just before I did this on like what your abdominals look like and stuff like that. I was like the obliques, and that there's like different, they go different directions and stuff. I was like, it's mind blowing. But like what you were saying at the beginning of this, the more you understand about that stuff, you can't help but affect it when you're at the gym or when you're, you know, trying to stay hydrated or whatever. You get a little bit more motivated, you know what I mean, to do the right thing when you see how it actually physically affects your body. So
absolutely
highly recommend checking out the stuff that they're working on over there. Justin, thanks a lot for coming on, man. That's a lot of fun.
Happy to be here.
That's it for today's episode. Thanks for spending some time with me and my friends. If you want to be better friends with me, then head over to travischappell.com/team.
to subscribe to my free newsletter, Your Friend Travis, where I share what's on my mind about life, building a business, raising kids, being married, and anything else I would normally share with my close circle of friends. That's travischappell.com/team. And my biggest ask of you, since I'm sharing my friends with you, is to share this episode with a friend of yours that hasn't listened to the show yet, and leave us a quick 5-star rating in Apple Podcasts and in Spotify. It would mean the world to us as it helps us make sure that this show continues to be more valuable to you. Thanks in advance, and I'll catch you on the next episode.
Spring, is that you? Warmer temps mean new Allbirds styles. Meet the Superlight Collection, the lightest ever shoes from Allbirds, now in fresh colors. They've designed must-have travel styles for when you need to jet. The lighter-than-air feel and barely-there fit make these shoes some of the most packable styles ever. That means more comfort and less baggage. Take the Superlight Tree Runner on your next adventure. Its cushy, lightweight foam midsole supports every step, and the extra outsole traction gives you the grip to just go for it. The eucalyptus fiber upper adds next-level breathability to keep you going all day. Plus, the Superlight Tree Runner is comfortable and ready to go right out of the box. So, what can you do in a Superlight shoe? What can't you do is the better question. And because they're super packable, the real question is, where are you taking them? Experience how Allbirds redefines comfort. Visit Allbirds.com and use code SUPER24 for a free pair of socks with a purchase of $48 or more. That's Allbirds.com, code SUPER24.
As humans, we're naturally driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. When I was looking to hire someone, it was so slow and overwhelming. I wish I had used Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform, with over 350 million global monthly visitors according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And Indeed doesn't just help you hire faster. 93% of employers agree Indeed delivers the highest quality matches compared to other job sites, according to a recent Indeed survey. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/podcast. That's Indeed.com/podcast. Terms and conditions apply.